Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will begin the study of the Satipatthana Sutta. And I want to really recommend for those who want to study the sutta very carefully the book by my friend Venerable Anālio, a book called Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. It's very, very thorough, very careful, very erudite study of the sutta. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's an excellent book. Okay, so this is sutta number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya, Satipatthana Sutta. And here it's translated The Foundations of Mindfulness. But I no longer agree with this rendering. A very nice sounding, very euphonic, sounds very pleasant. But I don't quite think it's quite correct. And I should mention also that the sutta has a counterpart in the Digha Nikaya called the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, the Great Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness. That is sutta number 22 of the Digha Nikaya. And it differs from the regular Satipatthana Sutta, the one in the Majjhima Nikaya, only in that it has an expanded section on the Four Noble Truths. That section on the Four Noble Truths, it seems to me almost as though it was an early commentary on that section which had gotten incorporated into the sutta in order to expand its size. Okay, so we come to the very beginning. And the sutta begins when the Buddha was living in an area, part of India, which is called the Kuru country, at a town, near a town of the Kurus named Kamasa Dhamma. The Kuru country corresponds to part of Uttar Pradesh today, close to where the capital city of Delhi is located. So it's pretty far from the area where the Buddha usually resided and taught, section which is now in the state of Bihar. In those days it was called Magadha. Okay, and so the Buddha calls the attention of the monks, and the monks reply to him. And the Buddha begins by saying, I'll just have to read this expression in Pali. Ekayano ayam bhikkhave maggo satanam visuddhiya soka paridevanam samatikamaya. Dukkha dominasanang atangamaya nyayasa adhikamaya nibanasa sachi kiriyaya yadidang chataro satipatthana. Okay, now there's an expression here, the very first word, ekayano ayam bhikkhave maggo, or put concisely, ekayana maga. Many translators of the sutta render this expression, this is the only way for the purification of beings, or some, this is the one way for the purification of beings. This is the sole way for the purification of beings. And this comes because we have this expression, I will write it on the board. Well, it's on the paper, no need to write it on the board. Ekayana Mugga. Ekayana Mugga. Okay, we have Eka means one. Ayana means going. And Mugga means path. So this is a one, literally, it's a one going path. And so if one neglects the word which means going, and one just takes Eka Mugga, then one gets the idea this is the one path, the only path, the sole path. But one has to take the two parts of that word together, Ekayana, one going. And the word occurs very rarely in Pali literature, but there is another place where it occurs, in the Majjhima Nikaya, just two suttas away, which sheds some light on its real meaning. This is in Sutta number 12. Let's see where it starts. On page 170. We have paragraph 37. And if you run down your eyes on the page, down this paragraph, you see where the simile begins. Suppose there were a charcoal pit. Do you see that? Okay, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals, without flame or smoke, and then a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by, what does he come by? It is an Ekayana Mugga. Ekayana Mugga going to that same charcoal pit. That is a path going in one way only, directed to that same charcoal pit. So Ekayana Mugga, and then this same expression is used for all the other similes. You have 5, 6 similes constructed according to the same pattern. So the idea here is that of a path which is going in one direction only. It's not a path which has different forks and branches, but it heads in one way only, straight towards a particular destination. And so the idea here seems to be that these four satipatthanas constitute a path which goes in one direction. And that one direction is towards the purification of being, towards the transcending, the surmounting, the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief or dejection, and for the attainment of what is called, translated here, as the true way. In Pali it is Nyaya. This would be the world-transcending path, supermundane path that we encountered in our study of the previous sutta, the discourse on the Great 40, Mahachatarisika Sutta, and for the realization of Nibbana. That is, okay, we have this expression now, the four satipatthanas. Okay, now it's common to render this expression four foundations of mindfulness. And it's a very nice sounding expression. It sort of rings true. and resonates with our mind when one's foundations for something. Except that there's a problem here in that expression, foundations of mindfulness, doesn't seem to agree with what the Pali was originally. Okay, this is what happened. Okay, sati is what is translated mindfulness. And satana can mean foundation. Might mean foundation. And so it would seem quite logical, you put sati, mindfulness, and satana together, you have foundations of mindfulness. But if somebody knows Pali, one knows that there's something that takes place in Pali called sandhi. Sandhi means when two letters of a particular type come together, they undergo certain changes. Certain changes take place. And now what happens when two vowels come together often is that one of the vowels will drop out. And now there's another expression used, or another word used very often in conjunction with sati. The word is upasana. Whereas it occurs very often in the verb form. Somebody dwells with upasita sati. It is said, for example, one of the qualities that the Buddha urges in a monk, he says that you should dwell with upatita sati, which would mean that you should dwell with mindfulness set up, with mindfulness established. And then one also comes across an expression, satting upatapetva, having set up mindfulness. Upatapetva. One gets this, in fact, just a few lines down in the same sutta at the beginning of the passage on mindfulness of breathing. When one starts the mindfulness of breathing, one begins by satting upatapetva, establishing mindfulness. And there are various other instances where sati is used together with this various forms based on upatahati, upatita, upatapetva. And so this would imply that the original form would have been sati plus upatana, and then through this process called sandhi, that is the meeting of two vowels. It's somewhat like in a chemical reaction when an atom of one thing, one substance, meets an atom of another. In order for them to link, I think a certain electron drops out of one of the orbits. I don't remember my chemistry so well. It's been quite a long time. So the U drops out in order to form satipatthana. And this agrees also with the Sanskrit tradition. When they render this expression in Sanskrit, they use smriti prasthana, but smriti upasthana, which means smriti is the same as sati, and upasthana is the same as always upasthana. So this would mean that what we have here is the four, I now would call it the four establishments of mindfulness, the four ways of setting up mindfulness, four ways of arousing mindfulness, four ways of four applications of mindfulness. And so when Ren does the four foundations of mindfulness, that sort of places a lot of emphasis upon the object of mindfulness. But when you say the four establishments of mindfulness, or four ways of applying mindfulness, fourfold application of mindfulness, it seems more comprehensive. It takes into account the whole process of setting up mindfulness, both the subjective factors as well as the objects of mindfulness. Okay, then right after this opening statement in which the Buddha introduces the four foundations of mindfulness as the direct path, the one-way going path, the path going in one direction, he makes a statement in which he elaborates on the four, what are the four foundations, we'll call them for these the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishments of mindfulness. Okay, he begins, what are the four? We're on paragraph 3. Here, a bhikkhu dwells, a bhikkhu abides, contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Then he abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I would render this somewhat different now, I would say. For covetousness and grief, maybe longing and dejection in regard to the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating, I would do this differently, contemplating phenomena as phenomena, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away longing and dejection in regard to the world. Okay, there's quite a lot in this little opening statement. Okay, first, the statement indicates that to practice any of these foundations or establishments of mindfulness, it's a way of dwelling or abiding. We have this word, one abides, viharati. I think it's baoche, correct? In Chinese, baoche. Then contemplating, this is how one abides, contemplating. The contemplating is the verb, well it's here, anupassana, but it turns into a noun form, anupassana. Now the word anupassi, like the word anupassana, it's based upon the sort of stem foundation part, means seeing, to see. Pasati means to see. But this is anu. It has the prefix anu, which means, suggests the idea of closely and repeatedly. So what is undertaken in the development of mindfulness is a close, careful observation of the object of mindfulness. Close, careful, repeated, even continuous observation of the object of mindfulness. And then we come across an expression which I should have been rendered literally, so it sounds a little strange to be, when you take it literally. You have to render this literally, kaye kai anupassi, it would be, he dwells contemplating the body in the body. Similarly, one, he dwells contemplating feelings in feelings. He dwells contemplating mind in mind. He dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena. So when we first read this, it seems a little puzzling. Why one should dwell, contemplate, how does one dwell contemplating the body in the body? You might think maybe inside this body there's another body to be observed. Maybe then, how does it work with feelings? Does it mean within my feelings there are other feelings to be observed? Within my mind, there's another mind to be observed. But I think this is said in order to show that when one takes up a particular contemplation, one has to call us, delimit the object of observation. Sort of put boundaries around it, and one keeps one's observation, one's contemplation focused upon that object, contemplating it simply as an object of that particular kind. That one is contemplating the body, one is contemplating it simply as a body. On the one hand, one is able to segregate the four foundations of mindfulness, four objects of mindfulness from each other, so that one is no longer mixing together, say, mind, feelings, and body, taking them as a mass. But when one undergoes experiences, one is able to segregate, to delimit the different domains within that experience. For example, if one is experiencing strong bodily pain within the meditation, one is able to distinguish what is the bodily component in that experience. And one is just observing the body as a body within that experience of pain. And one distinguishes that from the feeling aspect, the sheer experience of pain. And then one distinguishes that from the mind, that which is aware of the pain. And one distinguishes this from the different reactions to it, liking, dislike. Usually the pain would be disliking it, wanting to get rid of it. That would be some aspect of the phenomena base of mindfulness, the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So one distinguishes the different foundations of mindfulness, different bases, domains of mindfulness from each other, and one contemplates each one in its own domain, as its own domain, without letting them become mingled and merged with each other. And so one is able to distinguish different aspects of experience, isolate them. And then one also takes these different aspects of experience simply as they are, without identifying them as being I and mine. So one is able to break the net, or break the bond of identification with the body, with feelings, mind, and mental phenomena. Usually in our experience, we hardly even see the body as a body, but the sense of I, of being a self, is so integrated with the body that we virtually take the body just to be an extension of the sense of the self. And similarly with our feelings, with our thoughts, all of these are just experienced as different extensions or tentacles, branches of the sense of self. But when one applies this contemplation of these phenomena with mindfulness, then one is putting aside all identification, and one is taking each one just as a separate domain of observation. Just see it barely as the phenomenon of a particular sort. And this might raise the question why we have these four foundations of mindfulness. Why not begin right away with something like the five aggregates? The five aggregates will come in as objects of contemplation within the four foundations of mindfulness. They come in under contemplation of phenomena, dhammas. But I think the Buddha started to use a more practical approach in order to sort of connect us directly with our experience. Use it to begin with the five aggregates. For most people, would be too abstract. It requires, I'd say, a certain subtlety of awareness and a capacity for refined attention to be able to focus in upon the five aggregates as such. But the way we normally experience ourselves, our world, is first through the body. I would say like the two main components of experience are body and mind. Those are the two aspects of our subjective reality. So that gives us kaya and citta, body and mind, as foundations of mindfulness. But between body and mind, there's another important domain of subjective experience, and that is feeling. We call feeling is almost like the connecting link between body and mind. Since so much of our experience consists of feelings taking place through the sense faculties through which we connect with the world. And the sense faculties are what bring us information about the world. And as that world flows into the mind through our sense faculties, all of that information that comes in is accompanied by different feeling tones. And then feeling is also a very important aspect of our inner life, our moods, our attitudes, happy, sad, joyful, dejected, feeling balanced, apathetic. And so we have these different types of feelings, pleasant, painful, neutral feelings. So that gives us three foundations of mindfulness, three objective domains of mindfulness. And then another important aspect of our subjective experience of our inner life is the whole domain of, say, mental responses to our experience of the world. And then these the Buddha organizes into different categories or classes according to the purpose of the Dhamma. And so these, all these different aspects of experience that get organized and classified according to the purpose of the Dhamma, these become the fourth objective domain of mindfulness. The contemplation of phenomena, Dhamma anupassana, or Dhammas as an object of anupassana. Okay, so we have, one abides contemplating the body as a body or any of the other foundations. Now we have some other words here. In Pali, atapi sampajano satima. Okay, the word atapi, that's translated ardent. The word is atapi. You might have heard of the word tapas, tapa. There is a word, it's still very important in the Indian religious scene. It means austerity or ascetic practice. It comes from the idea of the root sense is that of heat, warm. And the idea here is that by ascetic practice, austerity, self-denial, one generates a kind of heat of spiritual energy, which then gives one spiritual powers, what's called iddhi, the powers to work what's called wonders, supernormal powers, or the power to gain liberation. This was an idea which goes back in Indian spirituality long before the time of the Buddha. And it still continues today. One sees, well, maybe Indian asceticism is dying out in favor of Indian software development and Indian engineering technology. But probably in the Himalayas, one could still find ascetics who are practicing tapas, fasting for long periods. If they're up in the Himalayas, right up by the glaciers, they'll be exposing their bodies almost naked to the ice and snow, standing on one leg for a long period of time, sitting during the middle of the day when it's blazing hot, sitting in front of starting fires all around one and sitting in the middle of having four fires right around one and sitting in the midst of the four fires. These are some of the ascetic practices. Okay, so the Buddha took over this idea of tapas from the Indian religious scene, but he gave it a completely different meaning. He rejects the idea of physical austerities, self-mortification, tormenting the body, but he uses the idea of atapi, tapa to mean the energy of diligent effort, of diligent striving for self-purification, to cleanse the mind of unwholesome states, and to bring into being pure or wholesome states. And of course, for the Buddha, the idea of extreme application of energy has to be tempered or balanced by the idea of applying energy skillfully in proper proportion, not going to any extreme, but balancing energy and effort with tranquility, with calmness, knowing when is the proper time to apply energy, when is the proper time to apply tranquility, or to be tranquil. Okay, then, so the contemplation is possessed of ardor or energy. Then, one who is applying or practicing this contemplation is also, here I put the word on the board, sampajano. Here it's translated fully aware. I don't really like that rendering so much now, because awareness is one of those words that you can use for almost anything. It has so many different meanings, it's just not clear at all. Some people use aware just when they wake to distinguish whether you're asleep, then you're not aware, when you wake up you're aware. Some say you're not aware till you gain perfect enlightenment. But the word sampajano comes from the root nya, which gives the verb janati, which means to know. And it has a prefix, two prefixes actually, sam, which gives a sense of fullness, and pa, which gives a sense of activity. So this is a full active knowing of what is taking place, we say, on successive moments of experience. And the word sampajanya, this is the noun. Sampajanya, this describes the person who has this clear, now I translate sampajanya as clear comprehension. So a person who has that quality is sampajano. He's one who's clearly comprehending. And the quality itself, sampajanya, is clear comprehension. It's closely related to the word Panya also comes from the same root, nya, janati, with the prefix pa. But sampajanya is not yet wisdom. We could call it the seed of wisdom. Sampajanya is the comprehension of what is taking place, a clear knowing of what is taking place. And it ranges from just a simple, we call it a simple awareness of what is going on, to a deep, discriminative understanding of what is taking place. And often in the suttas, we find sati and sampajanya occur in close conjunction. In fact, they form an expression, sati sampajanya. We have mindfulness and clear comprehension. And so we could say that mindfulness is what brings in the data of observation. Mindfulness is the awareness. Well, here's the awareness. I prefer awareness to mindfulness, or awareness to sati. It's a way of explaining mindfulness. Okay, mindfulness is the awareness that makes the experience, makes different aspects of experience accessible to our understanding. And then sampajanya is what comprehends them, the faculty of understanding them, of relating the data which are made available to us by mindfulness. And so we have, right after this, being fully aware or clearly comprehending, in the formula, we have the word mindful, here in the form satima, one who is possessed of mindfulness. And now we take this word sati, and the original meaning of sati was memory. It comes from the verb sarati, which means to remember. In fact, in normal Indian languages, that is the meaning of sati or smriti, is memory or remembrance. But the Buddha took this word from ordinary language and he gave it a special meaning, a new meaning. So sati now, occasionally in the suttas, it means memory of the past. But most often, especially in the meditative context, sati comes to mean remembering to be aware of the present. We could say sati is recollection of the present, remembering to be aware of the present. That is, it is presence of mind. Awareness, openness to what is happening. Clear, open awareness of what is happening in the present. And the special characteristic of sati is what we could call its receptive quality. That is, sati, or mindfulness, its function is not to discriminate, to judge, but simply to observe, to notice what is taking place. And sati can function in different ways. Sometimes it can zoom in very closely for close observation. That would be a kind of very focused awareness leading to concentration, or to very minute observation of different aspects of experience. And sati can also stand back to take a very broad, panoramic, comprehensive view of what is taking place within experience. And so mindfulness, or sati, is what opens the mind to all of these different dimensions of one's immediate experience and makes them accessible to sampajanya, clear comprehension. Clear comprehension is what is able to understand them, to distinguish them, to categorize them, to sort them out, to make sense of them. And then it is from this process of sorting, understanding, comprehending, that wisdom, panya, will arrive. Okay, then, to complete the opening formula, we have the expression, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Here, covetousness would be strong craving. Now I would use a word like longing or hankering. And for grief is too strong a word for dominasa. It's more simply a feeling of sadness or dejection. And it's sometimes taken to be almost a synonym for aversion or ill will. A kind of displeasure that arises when anything contrary to our wishes, to our desires, takes place. So it's said in the commentary that covetous and grief, or longing and dejection, signify the first two of the five hindrances, that is, sensual desire and ill will, craving and ill will. And the expression, having put away, this seems to imply that one has to have overcome sensual desire and ill will in order to practice the four foundations of mindfulness. But this is not actually the case, because as you will see, in the course of practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, when we get to contemplation of mind, when a mind of hatred arises, one has to be mindful of it. When a mind of craving or lust arises, one should be aware of it, to be mindful of it. Similarly, in contemplation of phenomena, when contemplating the mental objects, one has to contemplate the five hindrances. And so the five hindrances will arise in the course of practicing Satipatthana meditation. So it's not the case that in order to begin practicing Satipatthana, one has to have overcome the five hindrances. One has to have overcome sensual desire and ill will. But rather, this statement is made the way I would understand it, the way many others understand it, that this shows first what is taking place within Satipatthana practice. In the course of practice, one is putting away, overcoming longing, craving, and ill will, craving and aversion. And the goal towards which one is moving is the eventual complete overcoming of craving and aversion. Okay, this covers the opening statement. If there's any questions at this point? Okay, that... one can't have eradicated... Okay, that in the course of the practice, as one is going on with the practice, then one is putting away this longing or craving and aversion. That the practice is, part of the practice is putting away, overcoming, craving and aversion. And the direction in which the practice is moving is towards the complete overcoming of craving and aversion. Well, I think his practice that led to his enlightenment would have gone through the four satipatthanas. Though it's an interesting question that he didn't, obviously, on that night of his enlightenment, he didn't go through all of these exercises. He used just mindfulness of breathing. But mindfulness of breathing, as we'll see as we go on, not so much in this sutta, but the next one we'll take, which is called the Anapanasati Sutta. But mindfulness of breathing extends into all four foundations of mindfulness. So probably on the night of his enlightenment, when he developed the mindfulness of breathing, he took it into all four domains of mindfulness. But later, when he worked out the systematic practice of the four establishments of mindfulness, he included various other exercises which he did not himself practice before his enlightenment. Or perhaps he did, but they just haven't come down in the traditional account, like the contemplation of the bodily parts, contemplation of the elements. We don't see those in the traditional account of his enlightenment. But somehow he must have understood the importance and value of these contemplations through his enlightenment. Okay, Suki. That's a good way to understand it. I think that's a very good point too. Okay, her point is that a way to understand this phrase, vinaya loke abhijato manasang, that it doesn't mean that one has to completely put away longing and dejection before one starts the meditation. It doesn't mean one has to overcome it completely. But before one actually begins the meditative exercise, one should establish one's mind in such a state that one is not, say, at that time overcome or troubled by strong longing and dejection. I think that's quite a valid point. But also I could see situations where a person might be overcome by, say, a strong craving or else a strong grief, and they realize that this is a disturbance, a distraction, and I want to overcome this, and the way to overcome it is through establishing the mind in one of the four domains of mindfulness. So even when at the time one sits down, the mind might be obsessed by, on the one hand, with very strong cravings. On the other hand, one might be in a state of grief, dejection, or ill will. But then one just sits down and then applies oneself to contemplation. And as one does so, then those negative mental states start to fall away. And the mind settles down and becomes still and focused. But I think you made a good point. That's quite a useful observation. Atapi is actually an adjective qualifying the person. Yeah, it's one who is ardent. Yeah, those are all personal, they're like adjectives. Yeah. It's the person who has Sampajanya, yeah. But they're all describing this monk who's practicing it. He's atapi, which means ardent, fervent, or energetic. Sampajano means he's fully aware or clearly comprehending. And he's satima, mindful. It's actually functioning as an adjective. Yeah. The boundaries between nouns and adjectives are not very thick, strictly delimited in Pali. Any further questions? Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to go through the sutta bit by piece by piece. No. I'm just really dealing with the introductory passage. Okay, then let us go into at least the beginning of the section on mindfulness of breathing. Okay, now we come to the body of the sutta, which is divided into four main sections according to the four, so it's easier to say, okay, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four objective domains of mindfulness. And then so we have contemplation of the body, contemplation of feeling, contemplation of mind, contemplation of phenomena, and then some of them are divided into several sections because there are different exercises within those sections. And each of the main contemplations, main exercises, has attached to it what we call a refrain, which consists of four key phrases. I'll explain that when we come to the first refrain. Okay, so now we come to contemplation of the body. First exercise under that is mindfulness of breathing. So the question comes up, how does a bhikkhu dwell contemplating the body as a body? Here a bhikkhu gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, holding the body straight, and established mindfulness in front of him. And here we have that expression, satting upatapetva. Sati joined with the verb upatapeti, to set up, to establish. Ever mindful, he breathes in, or it's really just an emphatic, mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Okay, so it said that this is the first phase in mindfulness of breathing. Simply, when breathing in, to be aware of breathing in. When breathing out, simply to be aware of breathing out. And the key word there is, having established mindfulness in front of him, mindful, one breathes in. Mindful, one breathes out. So that emphasizes mindfulness as the awareness or observation of the in and out breathing. Now comes the second phrase, second phase. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. Okay, with this couplet, we have the verb here, pajanati. This means understands or knows. This introduces the element of sampajanya, or clear comprehension. Now one is not simply aware of the breath, but one is now knowing or comprehending whether the breath is long or short. At the beginning of the practice, when the breathing is gross, the breath is said to be long. As the breath becomes very subtle, settles down, then it becomes short. Okay, so one just simply understands or registers whether the breath is long, whether it's short. Okay, then the third phrase, he trains thus. And now we have a new verb introduced here. It changes from understanding to training, sikkhati. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. Now there's a way of explaining this in the commentary, Visuddhimagga, other commentaries. This is what the commentaries say. And before I give the explanation, I'll have to say I disagree with it. They say that what is meant here by experiencing the whole body is that one should be aware of the entire act of in-breathing from the very beginning when one is starting to breathe in through the middle phase all the way to the very end. Then when one is starting to breathe out, one is aware of the out-breath from the very beginning through the middle phase all the way to the very end. Then when one starts to breathe in, one is aware of the whole in-breath all the way from the beginning right through to the very end. When breathing out, one is aware of the whole out-breath from the beginning right through to the very end. So one has continuous, unbroken awareness of the entire in-breath, the entire out-breath. And the whole in-breath, whole out-breath, that is what is meant by the whole body. Okay, I think it's quite a valid point that one should be aware of the entire in-breath, the entire out-breath, because that is the practice, the training that enables one to keep continuity of mindfulness. And to increase the mindfulness so that it extends to the entire process of in and out breathing, so the mind doesn't wander in the course of the breath. But if one takes the word of the text, first one has this expression, sabbakaya, which means whole body. And it's rather contrived and artificial than to say, whole body means whole breath body. That is the entire in-breath, entire out-breath. It just, to my mind, it doesn't sound very convincing. And then the word experiencing here, the Pali is patisangvedi. You know, the word, the root of patisangvedi, ved, is also connected with vedana, feeling. So this is something, a much more concrete feeling or experiencing than can be suggested by the idea of simple, being simply aware of the breath as it goes in and out. I can't see this as meaning anything other than while one is breathing in and out with mindfulness, now the awareness, the attentive attention is now being diffused globally throughout the whole body, that one is now able to experience the whole body, taking it all in as a whole in its totality, while one is mindfully breathing in and out. And one is now letting the attention, or letting the awareness, the sensitivity, one's sensitivity extends through the entire body. And one can now, because as one attends to the breathing, the mind becomes very subtle, very sharp, very subtle. And so one can now extend that awareness throughout the whole body so that one can take in the body globally as a whole. And so one is now experiencing the whole body while one is breathing in, breathing out with mindfulness. And apparently this is something one has to train in. It says he trains thus: I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body. I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body. So one has to train in being able to extend that awareness throughout the whole body as one is breathing in and out. Then the next phrase says, he trains thus: I shall breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus: I shall breathe out tranquilizing the bodily formation. Here what is called bodily formation, this is kaya sankara, and there are some other suttas which identify what is the bodily formation. The bodily formation is the in and out breathing. And so what one is doing now is training oneself to tranquilize, to calm down the breathing, to make it very, very still, very soft, very quiet. And the breathing is also connected to many other processes taking place in the body. So as one, just through a simple act of advertence, of mental will, as one makes the body calm down, all the other processes in the body calm down. That the entire body becomes tranquil, calm, composed. And then the Buddha, the text, illustrates this with a simile of, this is called a turner, somebody working a lathe. Or his apprentice, when molding some object on a lathe, when making a long turn, he understands, I make a long turn. Or when making a short turn, he understands, I make a short turn. So too, when breathing in long, the bhikkhu understands, I breathe in long when making a short turn. When breathing in short, he understands I breathe in short, and so on. The passage repeats. Okay, I think I'll have to stop here and ask if there's any questions. Yet, initially, it's not a controlling of the breath in the way, say, in the practice of hatha yoga or pranayama, one is controlling the breath, one is attempting to breathe according to certain rhythms, breathe in for a count of 8 seconds, holding the breath for a certain count, then breathing out according to for a certain number of seconds, holding the breath out for a certain number of seconds. That's what I call the controlled breathing. And so one is just breathing at one's normal, natural rhythm, just being attentive to it. Okay, but as the mind becomes more and more concentrated, more collected, and is able to observe the breath more and more continuously, then it becomes possible, simply, it's not controlling the breath sort of in that forceful way that, or deliberate way that's done in hatha yoga, but just through what I call a very slight mental advertence, slight act of will, let the breath calm down, become still, then the breath will just become still and quiet. So if the mindfulness slips, then one will lose that stilling of the breath, and then it will become coarser and coarser again. You know, I flung shop in high school. I guess in those days they would have worked. Could it be with clay in those days? I don't know. Yeah. A lathe, I used a lathe of wood. That's what I mentioned that. Yeah. Here one has to make a deliberate effort. Understanding also requires a deliberate effort, but training requires this even more deliberation. Training is something one has to come back to again and again. So it's a verb form of sa-mi-ti, pasati sa-mi-ti, pajanati. The verb, it implies, it's a first person verb. So there's no reason to avoid the use of the first person. The Buddha doesn't avoid using it when necessary. It's just a convention. I don't see any reason to avoid it, since it's just a conventional expression, I. They probably think that if you're thinking in terms of I, that this is reinforcing the sense of self. But I don't think that that's the case, especially in the initial stage. You're just being aware. Actually, in the initial stage, when it's not really thinking, I'm breathing in long, when it's just really observing just whether it's a long breath or a short breath. But it would be too cumbersome to express that in the Pali. So the simple way to The simpler way to express that is simply to say, I am breathing in long, I am breathing out long, breathing in short, breathing out short. Yeah, but it seems to me that in my experience, when the breath calms down, or when the mind calms down, a single breath will take a longer time than when the mind is excited, restless. When one begins the practice, the mind is still excited. Then the breathing will take place more quickly. Because when the mind calms down, then the breathing will take a longer time. Or each breath will go more slowly, so that an in-breath, an out-breath will take a long time. And yet, it said that the long breath comes first, so that seems to represent an earlier stage than the short breath. So the way I would understand this is almost that a long breath seems to be a coarser breath, a short maybe a breath that taking place coarser, whereas the short breath, the breath is finer and subtler, so that it doesn't seem to be extending so far down in the lungs. And does anybody else have any idea about this? In my experience, the in-breath and out-breath seem to take a longer time when the mind becomes calm. Yeah. 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 Okay, just one more. Okay, see. Yeah, there's no specific place mentioned. This is a point also, maybe I should just clarify this. There's a phrase here at the beginning of the instruction. It says, it's this phrase, having established mindfulness in front of him. In Pali it goes, parimukkang sating upatapetva. Now parimukkang means literally, mukha could mean mouth, and pari or face, and pari means around. So some teachers say parimukkang means around the mouth, that is at the nostrils or the upper lip. But it seems to me that this phrase parimukkang sating upatapepa is just an idiom which has the sense of setting up mindfulness. Of course, it occurs also in other contexts, not only in relation to mindfulness of breathing. So, it might be the case that no specific point is, according to the original teaching, is prescribed as the place that one observes for mindfulness of breathing. But within the Theravada commentaries, they recommend attending to the breath at the nostrils or the upper lip. So I've heard some other teachers, even within the Theravada tradition, suggest observing the breathing any place where one could feel it distinctly, even if it will be the chest, the abdomen. It seems to me that if one wants to practice for jhana, to get the nimitta, the sign, to obtain the jhanas, that this area is the most suitable area. But to practice for insight, to develop mindfulness of breathing for insight, that this perhaps is not necessary, but it can be focused anywhere, wherever the breath is felt most distinctly. Okay, I think we have to stop now because we're going over the room. Quickly, the sharing of the mirror. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumodipa chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumodipa chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumodipa chirang rakantu mantaram. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sattha anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.